All right.
I'm a pretty big nerd.
Oh, yeah?
I've been a nerd for a good amount of my life. I mean, yeah, both of us have seen so many movies, it's kind of hard to say that we're not nerds just based off that fact alone, right?
Well, we're definitely old enough to have been nerds when it wasn't cool.
Yes.
Let's say that. It's definitely cooler now to be a nerd. I think it's more accepted. So I'm kind of enjoying my time now, but I'm getting to that point where I'm like, I used to like it when nobody else liked it, like nerds, you know?
That speaks to our successes. We've convinced the world around us that it's okay to be nerds, and they've caught on to the fact that, hey, those two guys, the people who know you, Philip's a cool guy. I mean, he's a nerd, too.
I like to think that that nerds are really just people that are passionate about something.
Yeah.
Whether it's about movies or NASA or something like that.
The Gathering.
Yeah, magic, right?
Dungeons and Dragons.
That's what we're talking about today, kiddies.
It is what we're going to talk about today. And this is the first time, correct me if I'm wrong, that we have or will be talking in depth about a kids movie. About a family film.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah,
this is outside of our, not our wheelhouse, but this is outside of our
usual.
So far, yeah, our curriculum of film that we've discussed.
Especially our last one we discussed.
Holy cow. This is, if you are coming off of of listening to our platform episode, which was our previous one, and you're coming on to Onward, this is going to be a weird one because it's weird for me to even think.
Yeah. Well, I love the movie Onward, and that's what we're talking about. Onward.
Onward.
The movie that was made
by... Not Upward.
Yeah, not Upward. Onward. And it was made by Pixar and Disney, right? And it's an interesting flick. It's got Chris Pratt and Tom Holland.
Mel
Julia
Rodriguez.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus.
Mel Rodriguez, who I love from Last Man on Earth, a TV show that was on Fox a couple of years ago. Yeah. He's a great character actor. He plays the Centaur police officer in this, or voices it.
Officer Bronco.
Yeah, I have a hard time saying plays the character in animated films. I always have to correct myself when it comes to that, because they're not really, they are playing it to a certain degree, but it's in a studio, they're boxed in. They have to get in character, but there's no.
Yeah, there's usually nobody else there. You're in a studio cubicle type of thing with
you
acoustics.
You get multiple reruns.
Yeah, I guess it's a little bit different on this one because Tom Holland and Chris Pratt had some
chemistry from the Marvel films.
Well, that, and they actually were recording sometimes together.
Ah,
and
nice.
They kind of like, you know, they had improvisations and everything is what I heard. I've seen a little bit of the making of it, so it was kind of cool.
I can't wait to hear more about that. And this movie's just interesting on multiple facets. The timing of the film, especially the release of the film, is going to be talked about for some time. This, in many ways, has been a win-loss for Disney. And they should take note of it because it made me look back at some of their films and say, I wish other Disney movies and Pixar movies would have been rolled out the way that Onward had to roll out because of the deal with the pandemic and the lack of box office numbers. And then it was brought on to be made purchasable on streaming platforms for about a week or two. And then Disney probably saw that their sales there were slacking and they said, okay, we're just going to make it Disney Plus.
Yeah. And I get it. So yeah, you're right.
It's interesting.
This is going to be historical. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it is a win loss. It actually came out March 6, 2020. It was actually in the theaters for 2 weeks before they realized they're
going
to have to shut down all the theaters, and they did make it available and they made it streaming for free. Now, the bad news for Disney is that they spent about $200 million on this film, which is quite a bit.
Which is like me or you spending $50 on energy drinks, let's be honest.
I don't know, man. You know, right now, as we speak, Disney's around $100 a share, while Netflix is over $400. So there's something for you. But it has probably to do with a lot of Disney spending on content, you know, like Star Wars, ESPN.
They've got some cashing up to do.
Marvel. They have much more content. They have catching up to do as far as the streaming world with Netflix, but as far as content or you know, merchandise or things like that, they're king. So
yeah.
I imagine that their stocks are lower because of all the spending that they've been making, but
there's
as
no
soon as
Netflix
that makes
land
around,
yet. There's no there's no place I can go to and ride Netflix original rides.
Yeah, but you know, they have Fox, you know, a bunch of things that they've gotten. But this movie, again, came out on Disney Plus streaming. And it's historical because of it. I'm really glad they decided to do that. And I told you,
it feels right. It's, and that's not diminishing the quality of the film. I would put this at least on par with the last 5 to 6 years. I would say it's in the upper tier of Pixar movies for a variety of reasons. There's been a lot of criticism of the movie in other areas that we may get into. But comparatively, as far as the original thought behind it and the creativity of the story and the attention to detail and the world, the visual design of the film itself, it is definitely in the upper class of Pixar films. And it being directly streamable and being of that caliber, I think is a good thing for Disney Plus, because as soon as The Mandalorian came out, it was the same sort of feeling. It was like, man, this looks, feels, and plays the part of Star Wars, but I'm getting it in the comfort of my home. This sets Disney apart from Netflix, because when you watch Netflix shows and originals for the most part, I get the straight-to-video vibe. And so I get...
Well, they're more adult-orientated. At this point, Disney seems to be really focused on family-friendly movies. And I don't understand why they haven't released their hard-hitting ones like Pulp Fiction and things of this sort. So they're still waiting to branch out.
Let's deep dive this...
Maybe they're getting demographics from it.
Let's deep dive this film right from the jump then.
Yeah.
And say Onward comes out in 2020, and Disney has finally... They spent the last decade remaking their animated movies from the 90s that we grew up on, and earlier than that even, and turning them into live action 3D. And they've received a lot of criticism for it. A lot of folks on the other side of the spectrum look forward to those movies. I can't relate to those people.
I'm not one of those people.
Me neither. What I look forward to from Disney are movies that still on the surface level are kid movies, Zootopias, Coco. Moana.
Those are so much more than kid movies, though.
I know, but that's what I look forward to.
And that's what this movie is.
Yes. Now, even the name of this movie, Onward, I think has a special... I spent a lot of time thinking of how it related to the movie, besides the fact that it's the transmission gear shift is set to O on Guinevere, and that it means onward. Okay, that's cute. That's the cutesy aspect of it.
That's the surface level.
The surface level. But the deeper dive of that title itself, and I'm jumping right into it here, so hold me back if we'll go back and revisit the cast and introduce everyone here in a second. But this is the direction Disney wants to go in this decade, is they do want to bring family-friendly stories that bleed from the Zootopia, like there's real stuff that 30-year-olds and 40-year-olds can get from it.
Well, Disney has definitely grown up with us. Right.
Yes.
You know, in the beginning, Disney was all about like Snow White and Bambi. They were just trying to do animation.
And that's speaking to the crowd and, back then.
Well, what I find that Disney seems to do is to find new ways to tell a story. Right. Most of the stories that they got were from like Grimm's Fairy Tales and, you know, Arabian Nights. And they were much, much more adult and grim. But, you know, they were able to put it like a positive spin to give people a message to be better people.
Yes.
And they used different mediums, like animation was the first time they made a lifelike animation with Snow White, right? And now Pixar was the first ones to ever come out with a 3D movie with Toy Story. That was the very first one. And the person that was part of that was John Lasseter. And I think that's why a lot of people have a little bit of criticism of this movie, because this is the first movie where John Lasseter is not at all involved with the movie. So it does have a little bit of a different feel than usual than what he's coming up with. And he stepped down as CEO of the animation in Walt Disney when they got bought by Pixar. He was part of the original think tank. He's usually the guy. I mean, he's a pretty big deal when it comes to Pixar and Disney. So.
He's the reason why all we were getting for the most part was sequels.
No, he was the reason why the movies were so good.
Oh.
Like, I mean, he's one of the people that thought up of the think tank room where everybody's opinion is on the same level as the CEO, as the janitor in that room. It's just literally a think room. And I think that's why they were able to get these stories that that attach themselves to so many people, and that is almost like a truth to everybody, because they are looking for the best story.
So much input.
Yeah, and what I like about that model is because Pixar is making a 3D animation movie, remember, it took at least 10 years to make the first Toy Story.
Yeah.
So anytime you're devoting that much time to a story, you better make sure that this is perfect, right? There is no loose ends or anything like that. It's perfect. And they don't have time to make an erroneous scene because that scene takes 3 months to make. You know, they're
I would
not
say Toy Story, now that you mention it, when it comes to animated films, it's pretty close to perfect.
Most of them are. Most of the Pixar ones are. If you actually look, and this is what I want to...
Cars 2, Cars 3.
Well, yeah. We're going to get into that because the Cars 2 and Cars 3 has a little bit of a connection to this movie.
Oh, really?
Yes. There's a lot of connections in the movie, and there's a lot of non-connections because... what I've noticed in Disney is they're taking a departure from tried and true filmmakers and they're trying new filmmakers. You know, they really are. They seem like they have this little testing ground.
Is that what Dan Scanlon?
Yes. So okay. I'm going to go over Dan Scanlon, who is the director of this movie. I'm going to go over a little bit about his. So this is his filmography.
His journey.
Yeah. So he's only had a few. One of them was Mater in the Ghost Light, which is a video in 2006.
Just a video?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
just a music video? Not even a music video.
Like the Ring video? Something somebody found?
Like a 58-minute video.
Okay.
You got Tracy, which was a mockumentary in 2009. And then he did Monsters University in 2013. So he got a shot, right? Which it seems like Disney gave him a shot at a sequel. They're like, we'll give you the third one. We'll see how you do then. It may go straight to video, but it was successful. So since it was successful.
This is the Russo's launching platform as well. That's how they were given Winter Soldier.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And since they did great, they were given more responsibility.
Proving grounds.
So after Monsters University, which was in 2013, he did Onward. So I'm guessing it took about 6-7 years in total for this to come about. And again, it's a tried, true proving ground.
Isn't this how most studios handle directors?
No, not really. Because when you think of Disney, they're probably thinking Monsters University. You could go straight to video, right? Same thing with like Lion King 2 and things like
that's
that.
True. But
if they give this director the first, you know, attempt and he does something well with it, they'll give him a better project, a more original project, like Onward. And with Dan Scanlon coming on board, this was a very personal project for him. This is actually movie is... about like his life as a child and growing up without knowing his dad.
This is a very personal story to people who have the same story.
And it's, you know, when you read it or when you hear about it, when he talks about it, you know, there's this part in the movie of Onward where he's depressed about his day, Ian Lightfoot, right? Mm-hmm. Who's played by Tom Holland. And he puts on a cassette tape of his dad talking to him, right? And he's talking back to him after the first playthrough. Yeah, and then
Where have we seen this before?
Well, that's
Guardians of the Galaxy.
Not really, because he's talking with his dad.
Oh,
he's kind of trying to make a conversation with him because he never knew his dad. And this happened to Dan Scanlon. Him and his brother found a cassette tapes of his dad's audio recordings, and that's how he got to know his dad.
Wow,
it's a pretty significant thing to bring to your art, and I think that's why it speaks too true. Now, I wanted to talk about, you said what Walt Disney is going through, like their direction. What I see their direction in, which I kind of really like, is that all of their movies seem to go from this old trope of princess marries a prince. And now they're all about friendship. Even Frozen, right, is not really about marrying the prince. That's what the ruse was.
Yeah.
It's really about the brotherly love now with Onward. Mm-hmm. You have these, and I enjoy that because
Wrestling can't do. Wrestling can't figure out how to reinvent itself based on what made it so successful, even though that's what it's always done to sustain is it's reinvented itself, but it's capped out. It can't figure it out anymore.
Well, it's a male soap opera, so... But this is children's soap opera.
Disney built a model under being children's soap opera and sort of tapping into the subjects and the material that was, for better or worse, what they thought was age appropriate and what they could sort of funnel towards kids to teach them more about the bigger picture of the world and what they would have to get. I mean, you watch Bambi. Bambi's a dark movie. Mm-hmm. Dumbo's a dark movie. Aladdin's a dark movie. Lion King's a dark movie. All of these films that we grew up on are, when you're in your 30s, you look back and you say, wow, how did I not see how dark this was? That's because that's what Disney does well, is they mask the darkness and the real emotional gusto that these movies have concealed within them until you reach a certain age, because you have to. You can't you can't sit down and have a discussion with your 7-year-old about how serious Bambi is.
Well, you can, but I'm saying that, you know, with this movie though, I find that Disney has grown up because not only are they telling two stories, right? One for the kid, one for the adult that takes them, which is, they never used to do that before.
It's beautiful.
Right. I know that takes a certain level of intelligence, right? Third, yes. They're not telling the, you know, boy meets girl anymore, right? This is another
is a brotherly, takes a little brotherly bit more intelligence, I think. Parents and loss, living with loss.
I love that. And fourth, there's not even a real villain in this movie. When you think about it.
There's not.
So there's no more until black and white, you know? If anything, the villain and the hero live all in each other, you know? And I see that more from Disney, that they're saying, this is up to you.
Yeah.
This, not everybody's just going to be a Maleficent. Even Maleficent has become somewhat of a good girl, bad girl type
Mistress
thing.
Mistress of evil. And then she turns out to be the good, the protagonist for the most part.
Yeah. So it's like
in the sequel, at least.
They're really dealing with what is a villain. It seems like Disney's really trying to bake down or trying to figure out more than just boy meets girl, princess, and they're like, they almost seem like they have a social change amongst themselves. Like, we need to be more responsible with that message, and that there's more types of love.
It's good to see that out of a megalopoly, is what
I would call them. So I like Disney a lot, honestly. I usually like most of their stuff, and this I loved. I actually like this movie more than most of the Pixar and Disney movies that have come out in the last 5 years.
Like, I would agree. I need to revisit Coco again because I really like that movie a lot first viewing.
So Coco has a lot of connections to this too, and I'm going to go through it. And Coco's another one of those movies for me. To me, that one didn't straddle kid and adult. I felt like it could have been a little too dark for kids, like figuring out what death is. It was probably the easiest thing, or it was the best conversation I've ever seen.
But that's what Bambi did too.
I know, but that one was rough. That was just like, that was like old Yeller style. Like, that's death, kids. No, but this one really tried to have an easy conversation about death, or at least Coco did. And we can get into that later. We can have a whole
thing
on
Coco. Upward. Upward tries
up
to...
Up or Onward?
Which geez, one? Onward, sorry.
Onward!
Yeah, Onward does a good job of talking about death.
The loss of a father. And man, I love this movie so much, man, because one, I love road trip movies, okay?
Me too.
Two, I love fantasy. I'm all about that. Dungeons and Dragons and
magic,
Skyrim.
It's Magic the Gathering, yeah. Lord of the Rings.
I love magic. I'm
and
a sucker for it.
There's tip of the hats to everything in this movie. Everything that
Every
you
fantasy,
love about fantasy,
Lord of the Rings.
There's tip of the hat. It feels like a World of Warcraft movie in the fact that it's questing involved and all that. There's Dungeons and Dragons ode. To it, there's probably
Quests
a
of
reference.
Yore is what they call it in there.
There's
by
probably,
the way,
and
Quests of Yore Magic the Gathering is going to become a real board game.
Oh yeah,
apparently the Barley's version edition. Apparently,
that's not surprising. And this is where my criticism of Disney comes into play. They milk their properties for everything,
dude. I'm not gonna lie, I'm gonna buy it.
I bought the Villainous game,
dude.
The Villainous board games where they turn every villain, a historical classic villain, into a character you can play as.
Sweet.
And, yeah.
I mean,
it's a great game.
Dude, for years I wanted to get the original Jumanji game. Like, when I saw that movie, and today they still they sell the board, but I want the wood one. I want if they sold that, I'd buy it. Like, I just like that kind of stuff, you know, that kind of memorabilia.
The vintage one.
Yeah, I don't really like to buy stuff that's like, oh, buy this.
Jumanji wasn't Disney.
Oh, anyway, stuff like that from
DreamWorks.
Yeah, it was DreamWorks. And in two credit, a lot of people say that this movie feels like a DreamWorks 3D animation.
It does feel a little Ice Age-y mixed with, it does have that vibe to it, but that's okay. And that may be the animation style.
It's the animation style, I would say. And let's get into the animation style, by the way.
Let's do it.
Because this is going to be the first time I actually take the art director into account, because
well,
I think
to.
they have a big role, not just the director. We already went over Dan Scanlon a little bit, but I'm going to go over the art director. His name is Burt Barry. He did WALL-E in 2008, Cars 2, Inside Out 2015, Finding Dory in 2016, Coco in 2017, and Cars 3 and Onward. So as you can see, the man seems to bring that art concept.
Yeah.
If you can actually follow it a little bit of what he's bringing to the table. And that's why I said Coco. That's why you probably like this. It has more of a, and even Coco had a little bit of different feel than Toy Story, right?
Oh yeah,
they're much more radical.
Well,
some
that's
of these
because
movies.
Of the. Well, that's another testament to the last decade of Disney and the good that they've done. On the other end of the spectrum, you have all the remakes, the live action ones. Yeah,
I'm not a live action fan, so
when it comes to Disney, I'm not either. But
oh yeah, Disney.
The good action. Stuff that they came out with in the last decade are the movies like Inside Out, the movies like Coco, the movies like Moana. Wally was the previous decade.
Oh yeah, but I love that movie.
It's a great
it so
movie.
Good.
It's timeless too. Unfortunately, we're living
Inside
in a Wally.
Inside Out was good.
Inside Out was great.
Original movies, you know.
Yeah, the original ones are great, and the ones that have some sort of cultural heritage context to them too are even they take it up a notch as well, because that is the territory that you're in if you're Disney these days. There are so many individual stories out there from cultures and heritages that are significant that they, for better or worse, weren't willing to tap into. Well, you know, I can say that, but at the same time, Aladdin is a pretty cultural heritage movie, but they steered
but
away from
it. Nothing like Arabian Nights, if you read the original book, which I have over here.
For the most part, in the 20th century, they stayed away from it because they were building their brand. And now that they've got their brand built, they have the flexibility to tell these more personal stories. And I'm not saying Onward. I wanted to say Upward again. I'm not saying Onward is a cultural story, but it is a shift even more so to a microculture, to the fantasy nerddom. Just yeah. Juiciness that's out there.
To us.
Yeah, exactly. To the people who aren't out there.
Girls, boys, yeah. I mean, transgender, whatever. If you're into fantasy worlds.
This is your Disney movie.
Yeah, this is like what I would want to show my kids. Like, I love this movie, man. Like, I've watched it 3 or 4 times just out of sheer enjoyment. Like, not even breaking down analysis, which there is quite a bit of analysis in this movie, more than I thought originally. I thought maybe I might not have too much to talk about it because I just enjoyed it.
I told you this episode should be our shortest and might be our shortest, but now already 20 minutes into it, I'm realizing I was wrong.
Yeah, man, this is a good movie. And I wanted to go over a couple of things too before we get into anything else. Let's go over the writers. This is a strange one. So Dan Scanlon, I bet you had a good amount of writing. And all three of these writers have story by and screenplay by, which is unusual. All three would get those credits, so that means they must have, I think they must have started all together in the beginning. But Scanlon, when they say story by, usually it's like the elements of the characters and things like that, things that they're making up, right?
Or it's just story like by. Yeah, somebody coming in and saying, hey, this is my personal story and I'd like to turn it into a Pixar movie.
Well, that depends. That might be written by.
Okay.
You know, so there's a difference between screenplay by. So the screenplay by means that they helped on the actual screenplay, the format,
technical,
the writing on
details.
It, you know, the scenes. But the story by is like, okay, who came up with the characters? Who came up with the world? Who came up with this? You know, so it's weird that all three of them got that. So they all must have worked very close together in order to get that story by. But the other two besides Dan Scanlon is Keith Boonen and Jason Headley. And honestly, it's weird, but they don't really have much writing credit. I would say
that's not weird.
Keith Boonen, the one that you might know is Horns, and he did the screenplay by, you know, with Daniel Radcliffe.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, yeah, where the devil horns start coming.
Yeah,
out.
And then Jason Headley did one called A Bad Idea Gone Wrong in 2017.
So I don't want to crack the case too early here, but if you and I are making a fantasy movie that's trying to encompass all of the lore of fantasies, I came in to your home today and said, you know, the thing about Onward that I love is that we're going to take something different from it because our understanding of the fantasy world is different. You are a Dungeons and Dragons guy and a Lord of the
Elder
Rings
Scrolls.
Guy and a Game of Thrones guy.
Yeah.
I'm a Magic the Gathering guy. Like strictly Magic the Gathering with some elements of Fallout and Elder Scrolls.
I'm thinking
as well.
I think we come together when it comes probably to Legend of Zelda.
Yes.
Probably to Skyrim.
If Disney hands us $200 million to make a movie that tackles all of what fantasy is about, you and me can't do it alone. So we have to bring in people that we know bring different facets of the story.
Yeah, like
in.
The person that builds the world, the person
yes.
that keeps the lore. Like
so,
the
I don't
history.
Want to crack the case, but
you're
I bet you,
right.
I bet you, all of these guys know each other in real life. And Dan Scanlon's story, he's like, who else this movie took some time to evolve. So he's like, who else can I bring in who knows like who's the areas like that me. Who's a geek like me but and complements it in a different way. And it's probably these two
now
guys.
Are they could be friends from before, or maybe they became friends after, who knows? Maybe you know, I wonder about that. So we got the writer, the director. Here's one that's a different one too, the cinematographer. And this is, I'm going to get a little deep on this. So there's two cinematographers. And from what I've gathered from the information, and usually there's not two director of photographies or DP, or you can call it a cinematographer. They're the same thing, right? The two people that are different, one of them's called the camera DP, which is Adam Habib. And the other one's lighting DP.
Explain to me how there are cameras involved, period.
This is what I'm going to get into. Okay. So this is what I've learned. Usually your DP is going to be just dealing with camera movements, lighting, all that. He's, you have the gaffer, which is head of lighting and electricity and all that. But he works along with the DP, the director of photography, right? He needs it lit a certain way. So he's telling the guy this, and this is what I need. This is the camera movement. This is how I'm going to move it. But in an animation, what I found out.
These are all people behind computers.
Yes, so it's a much bigger problem because they're creating everything from scratch. And the way that the animation works is, so this is, I got to get into Sharon Callahan, the lighting DP. Why she's considered like the DP or cinematographer. So when you go to a cinematography buy, it has these two, but it does not say camera DP or lighting DP. I had to ascertain that information from their little documentary that they did about it.
Nice.
With their title.
Added value.
A little bit added. And so with Sharon, I thought maybe she was the original cinematographer and the other guy was just getting credit. Not at all. And the reason why I thought she was because of her lineup. She's done A Bug's Life, Toy Story 2 in 99, Finding Nemo in 03, Ratatouille in 07, Cars 2 in 2011, The Good Dinosaur in 2015, and Onward in 2020. So I thought for sure she's probably the cinematographer because she has this huge lineup. The other guy, Adam Habib, doesn't have anything really except for short films. So I was like, okay, maybe he just got on there. No, absolutely not. This guy actually is pulling his own weight and more. He's in charge of the camera movement, camera DP, right? So he's going to be the one say, I need to push in here. He's going to be the one that's going to communicate how I'm going to communicate to the audience.
You would think there's almost more work to be done in an animated feature as far as the direction of the camera and where it pans, because you don't have the physical example to say, like, you're talking over someone's shoulder, you're communicating with them, like, I need it to go here and here.
I think there's even more to it. So on set, usually what you do, like, okay, I'm a cinematographer, I'm going to get on there, I'm going to set up my camera, I'm going to say, okay, I'm going to mark my guys by blocking them out, like, hey, you stand over here, you stand over here. Then I get my lights in place so I can light them where my camera angle's at.
Now you have to communicate with the animation guys.
So now what they're doing is they have a room, right, of just gray pixels. Like, they can see the walls almost like Doom-esque style, right? They start from scratch. Okay, I'm going to have the guy blocked over here. So every camera movement, remember, a good director is going to look at a movie and say, this is the way it needs to be filmed, because every camera movement, I know what that communicates. This communicates stress. This communicates thrill. This communicates happiness. I'm going to make him laugh with this, right? So this guy has to take about 7 years of his life and figure out each movement according to the goal that the director wants a person to feel. So this is how in-depth they get, right? Just in Ian Lightfoot, this is his camera movements. For each person, they've limited camera movements or try to convey a certain thing. So,
sure.
So
the
Ian Lightfoot,
personality
of the character,
yep.
Right? So Ian is the thing of order, right? He's the one portraying order, right?
He's also not the middle child.
So they used
the younger child.
Yeah. So they used 40 to 55 millimeter lenses almost exclusively on him, which is more of, if you're using a 40 to 50, 50 is considered what your eye sees. And so most people use a 50 millimeter when they're making portraits of a person, make them nice, like headshots and stuff, right? A lot of people use it for street photography too. Everybody uses it for different, but most people concur that 50 millimeter, 35 to 50 millimeter is where the eye is seeing it. Some people say 35, some people say 50. Now, it's more centered composition. There's more straight lines in his viewing, static and mechanical movements only, a little or no tilt, and there's longer takes or less cuts, if you want to say that. Now, when they're shooting Barley, his brother, which is Chaos portraying, they're doing it with mostly Steadicam and handheld movement. They're doing high and low angles, curved diagonal lines, shorter takes and more cuts, pushed in compositions and barrel distortions.
So I get all of that, and it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah,
and I'm glad
that's just for the characters. That's not even talking about
what are they doing when they're both on screen.
Okay, so yeah, let's go into that, because Ian comes up with some problems. Ian Lightfoot, at least this is what Sharon was talking about, who is the lighting DP. So this is why it's separate. So in a 3D world like that, you're having somebody do the camera movements, but after, or I don't even know if it comes before or after, but the person has to put a lighting source in there, or multiple lighting sources, the different colors. And each one of those colors has a different effect on the blue skin tone. So sure, if you add a yellow, they're going to turn green. So she has all these other things in, or all these other tasks at hand besides the camera movement. So if the camera's going to move from left to right on Ian, she's saying, well, I have to light him horizontally. Well, one, because his nose is big and he's very vertical. And if I light him vertically, he's going to look contrasty
a different
and
hue
look bad.
Of blue.
Yeah, yeah, so they're actually putting soft light on him and horizontal
which
light on him.
Which also conveys his personality.
Yeah, yeah, but also to make him more pleasing to the eye. You know, you want to make him look better because his features are hard. So if you look at Barley, he's got softer features. He's chubbier.
Yeah.
So you don't need to
it's
worry
very
about
Chris
lighting.
Pratt-like.
Yeah. But the lighting, though, is if you, okay, so one of the things about lighting is if I'm going to light a model, I'm going to light her with soft lighting, and I'm going to light her with usually multiple lights, because if I just have one harsh light and it's sharp, it's going to be contrasty. It's going to show her lines more, her wrinkles more. There's all these rules that when you're lighting somebody,
I'm going to
want them to make
it
look beautiful.
Couple of candles.
you can scented. Actually. Stanley Kubrick had to develop a new camera to film under just candlelight under Barry
Which
Lyndon.
Film? Okay.
So he didn't use any lights, just candles. Mm. So you can, but
you've
just
recently done some lighting on a show as well.
Yes, I've been doing lighting for a little bit, and I do a little bit of cinematography. I'm not anything to.
This is your wheelhouse, I could tell.
Yeah, I really love this stuff because I didn't think that, and I should have known that something like Onward that takes years and years. I mean, usually your movie is going to take about a year to 2 years to make.
If that.
7 years, mm-hmm. 7 years. So, you know, I can't fathom the type of the amount of work and the amount of effort they put into each individual scene, mm-hmm. and what that's going to convey. And that's why movies like this are so tight, because they put so much time and focus that they're not going to just not kill their baby. It's a term in film is kill your babies.
Yeah.
Meaning that this scene might have taken the longest to shoot. It was the hardest to shoot. And you believed in this scene. But when you're cutting the movie together, it doesn't work. So you have to throw it away. And that's killing your babies.
You know, it also, in a strange way, rationalizes the exuberant budgets that Disney's throwing out. Because $200 million over the span of 7 years is really just a $20 million movie. Well, maybe my math's off a little bit. It's like a $30 million movie that took a year to make.
Yeah.
So if, and there are bad animated movies out there that are rushed, that are on lesser platforms, that have $10 million budgets that nobody ever hears about, that are really, you know, not well put together films. But this is the cream of the crop when it comes to animation. And Disney Pixar is knowingly in control of the direction that animated films go in the future. Onward. They are saying, like, we are the peak. And it's going to come. Even DreamWorks, Sony, all of the subsidiaries of not only quality, but the animation itself, they all know Disney's the godfather of this stuff. And what Disney does, it's like playing catch up for a lot of these yeah, companies.
Or Pixar.
They
really
try to match them, just like Disney's trying to match Netflix weirdly in the streaming platform. It's a weird thing.
I honestly don't even think they're trying to match them. It's just that Netflix has enjoyed no competitors for like 5 to 10 years. Nobody else is, I mean, Hulu's not even close. So Disney is going to be the only real competitor. Nobody else has the money or the resources to compete at all. And that's why you see Netflix just buying up everything, because they know they're about to go to war with Disney. They just don't have enough content.
Yeah.
The only thing that they have head start is actually on the streaming service. They have all the logistics. They have everything. You know, they're way ahead in that era, but Disney will catch up.
It's crazy how a discussion about a kid's movie can open up the realm of all of these smaller discussion points that are pertinent to the movie itself.
We haven't even said what the movie's about.
Yes. let's start with the movie part of this episode by introducing Ian, who is
played by Tom Holland.
Most people know him as the new Spider-Man in Far From Home, and
he used to play Billy Elliot on stage too. That was his claim to fame. He was a dancer.
Nice.
But he's basically just playing himself.
I found the choice to be interesting because Ian is American, or not American, English speaking. English speaking.
I wonder why they didn't let him speak English. That's more fantasy. Like, when you think about it.
That's true.
I feel like elves would speak in English.
Yeah, that's true. This movie opens up with an introduction to the world that then Onward is going to present. And it gives us a little bit of a history lesson on the fact that it's this world like Zootopia, kind of, where instead of animals, it's all the fantasy creatures that have ever existed inhabiting this one world together. And magic did exist in this world a long time ago, but over time, just like in the real world, magic's a lot more difficult to hone and to practice.
Well, there's still magic.
It requires effort and diligence. And so people have always, over time, tried to find shortcut ways of
convenience,
exactly. And even in this world, the creatures that inhabit it rely on convenience, and it's eroded into this Wall-E-like future where some, you know, the unicorns are bashing each other's head and fighting over garbage.
Well, that's actually old, sir.
Oh, yeah?
The original unicorns were feral, and they were, like, not nice in the old fairy tale books. Yeah, that's where that comes from. So if you actually look at some
Ridley
of things,
Scott for my...
Legend.
Yeah. Well, not only Legend, Blade Runner, too.
Yeah,
there's unicorn references of Blade Runner.
But, yeah, I mean, they actually take a lot of the older stuff and put it in this movie, which I'm kind of like, wow, they really went there. But, yeah, the unicorns were hilarious to me.
Manticores and
the manticore
sprites
was actually directly lifted from Dungeons and Dragons. That's an actual real, like,
really?
Yeah, that's a real thing that you can fight, a manticore. Except they messed up that the because it's got a lion body, dragon wings, a scorpion tail, and a human face though.
Oh, okay.
So they kind of just went cartoony.
Well, they can't
with that.
Do human. They do human faces with the. With the main character.
I mean, there's elves and stuff like that. So there's no human. Is there humans in there? I didn't actually check.
There's not a single human in this movie.
Yeah, I didn't think so. But
there's a centaur.
Dungeons and Dragons. Actually, if you've ever played Dungeons and Dragons, you'll notice a few things that were just. And you know, the thing is that the. Sorry, I wrote this down because Wizards of the Coast confirmed it did collaborate with this movie, Disney and Pixar. That way they could deliver like Dungeons and Dragons characters and stories in an appropriate way.
Okay.
And one of the things that they talk about was the gelatinous cube.
Yeah.
Straight from Dungeons and Dragons, level 2, you know.
Straight from...
It's very slow, but once you get caught in it, you did. You did. I mean, you can come up with some weird stuff to get through it, but that's later in the movie. They're talking about gelatinous cube the whole time, and then you finally see it at the end.
Earlier in the movie, we're introduced to Ian's main character, present day, after we're given that brief narration, which I'm assuming is from their dad.
You know, I didn't think about that.
I think it's
who
from
did the narration?
Dad.
Yeah, it is. It is a little sad how, you know, they just gave up magic for the light switch, you know? I'm like, oh, but that is real life. That's totally true.
Yeah, it is.
We give up a lot of magic today for convenience, and we don't even realize it.
But there's that bit of magic that still exists and is waiting for us to bring it back.
That's right. Put down your phones.
Yeah, exactly.
Go outside.
There's no magic to be had in your phones, believe me.
Or maybe our phones are magic. That's how they work. Little wizards in there.
You mean 5G's reactivating our propensity for magic?
Magic's just gamma rays, bro.
Yeah, maybe we'll all be walking around like electros.
It is very sci-fi that we have, you know, the Star Trek-like intercoms that we could just look up anything on.
Yes, but that's all they can do.
It's still magical.
It is.
Anyways, we're back to Onward.
Yeah, so
Ian Lightfoot and
Ian
Barley Lightfoot.
And Barley are brothers. Barley, I want to say, is graduated from high school and, like, you know, the college big brother who...
Is he in college? I think he's still in high school. He's about to go to college, right?
No, I don't. Barley and no, because
they're talking about Barley.
Yeah, Barley.
Okay, I was thinking Ian's in high school.
No, Barley is graduated from high school. Ian is in high school, and
Barley is definitely not in college.
No, no, but he's college level. Age-wise. So he's in his early 20s, and Ian is in his late teens, or mid-teens, 16, 17-year-old.
Yeah, trying to make friends like the rest of us.
Varying personalities, just like your a big brother and a younger brother would have. I have two younger brothers myself, so I saw a lot of Barley in myself who's trying to steer your little brother down the path that you are on, literally and figuratively, because he tries to do that later on in the movie.
I love Barley. He's actually my favorite. Like, even though, you know, I think Ian's a good place to start where people will have common ground.
Yeah.
I try to tell people this all the time, that a lot of guys that I know had a real hard time talking to people. A lot of people do, not just guys, but I think I'm a sucker for that kind of person that has trouble talking to people or making friends, that knows what they want, but they just can't bring themselves to do to get over the fear, you know.
That's Ian in a nutshell,
and I love that about him.
And he tries to he's at least proactive about what he needs to do to get over his fear.
He writes his lists.
He's not really an introvert. He is trying to figure out how not to become an introvert and how not to fall into that sense of
he's trying to be like his dad.
Yes,
he looks up
and
to his dad.
Older brother to a certain degree.
I think he does look up to his brother, but he doesn't realize it. And that's part of the movie.
Yeah, that's part of the film.
Yeah, I think that's what I love about that, though, that message. And that's why I think the ending to this movie is the best ending that it could have done. Because I don't...
It is a little bit of a curveball. It's not what you expect. We'll get to it.
But that's what makes it so great.
Yes.
Because if they would have ended it the other way, it wouldn't have the same impact at all. I would not have felt that.
I haven't shed a tear in a film since Man on Fire, 2007. Yeah.
Somehow you brought up Man on Fire during a Disney movie.
Got to.
Every podcast.
Well... Well, I mention it because this movie brought a tear to my eye, and it was in the last 5 minutes. Also, when that song kicks on at the end, it's the credit song. I don't know what the name of that song is, but the lyrics of that song just, yeah, coming from a music background itself, that song tied to what the movie had just put on display tied it all back together so beautifully.
I forget. Was it a composed song or was it a song?
Oh, yeah. It's an original song.
Okay. Well, then I think this is a good place to mention the composers.
Okay.
Because I want to bring... Which is... It's a good good little thing because the composers are actually brothers.
Oh, dun, dun, makes dun, sense.
That they don't always work together, though. That's what's interesting about it. They definitely work together. Jeff Dana is the younger brother. He did The Good Dinosaur in 2015. the Kid Stays in the Picture in 2002, which is a good documentary. Resident Evil Apocalypse 2004, Tideland in 2005, Silent Hill in 2006, Fracture in 2007, The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus in 2009. So
he's got a serious sort of sci-fi track record.
Yeah,
sci-fi horror. Which
now
is interesting.
Let's look at Michael Dana. And Michael Dana, you probably know him a little bit better. He's got some heavy hitters here. He's won some Oscars as well for his music. But he did a Little Miss Sunshine in 06, Moneyball in 2011, Life of Pi in 2012, 500 Days of Summer in 2009, The Time Traveler's Wife in 09, Capote in 05. He also did 8mm in
09. You know how I feel about Time Traveler's Wife.
Oh, I know. Girl Interrupted in 99. I think he won the Oscar for that too. Johnny Mnemonic in 95. The Japanese released director's cut version, though. I think that's
of
only.
Johnny Mnemonic.
Yeah, so.
Bro, now I gotta see this movie. The Japanese version of Johnny Mnemonic,
not just the Japanese version, the director's cut of the Japanese version. Just putting that out there,
man.
That's a very specific thing, man. But these are very. They have very different. I think they have very different styles, but they came together for this, and they came together for a couple of movies too. More for Jeff's movies than Michael, and who's the main guy who wins most of the Oscars and stuff. But I thought that was quite interesting that they're brothers, and this is a brother movie. And Dan Scanlon probably knew that.
Dan Scanlon is probably a younger brother as well to an older brother, because the main protagonist is Ian, and you're sort of taken along on his journey. But at the same time, it's simultaneous journeys because both of these kids have experienced loss in their life. They live with their mother, and their mother has remarried.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I always wondered how that came.
Yeah, Julia Louis-Dreyfus. Yeah, it's easier to say.
I'm like Louis Dreyfus. I mean, I'm watching Seinfeld again, but...
Yeah. Her mom, they live with their mom, and their stepdad? Is he confirmed stepdad or dating?
I think stepdad.
Okay.
I mean, every time he calls, the Al Green song comes on.
Yeah, that's right.
Or was it Al Green? I know. Let's get it on.
Let's get it on.
That's not Al Green. Yeah, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's Marvin Gaye.
Marvin Gaye. That's right. Yeah.
Not Al Green.
Yeah.
Shout outs to the big jazz and R&B soul fans out there.
Yeah. Plus, he's got that long Fabio hair, man.
Yeah. I love the centaur character. But yes, their father, their birth father, has passed on. You get to understand that very early on. Wilmer Valderrama has a cameo in this as the voice of the character in the restaurant who notices Ian's sweatshirt and says, you go to that high school?
That's Wilmer?
Yeah, it's Wilmer Valderrama.
All my research, I missed that.
Yeah. It's all right. Wilmer Valderrama is pretty missable.
Or Fez, it's okay. From That 70s Show, if you don't know who yes. Wilmer is.
So the opening scene of the introduction to the brothers is Ian's birthday, and he receives a sweatshirt, or he puts on the sweatshirt that mm-hmm. his dad used to wear. And then the introduction to his older brother, Barley, is a scene that sort of destroys a little bit of that sweatshirt. And even that is poignant in itself because...
You just got to pull it, man.
Yeah, I don't have I do actually have brothers from my biological father who I never met, but I can put myself in the shoes of Ian here saying I never got any time with my dad. Similarly, in real life, I never got any time with my dad. If I had an older brother who had time with my dad and was able to convey a little bit more of his personality through not only himself, but through his experience and time spent with him, I would feel a little like I got the short end of the stick. And that's what Ian feels like. And this Absolutely. One thing that he's got is his sweatshirt. And Barley's chipping away at that too by pulling the thread out. And, you know, it brings up interesting conversations. Are you a little resentful to an older brother who did get more time with a lost family member? It's weird, right? It's the whole journey that we're taking on this movie that is pretty serious because there are kids in these situations who, these are emotions you can't really mask. They surface. They realize themselves. They're unavoidable. How do you react to that particular situation? And I love that Disney was willing to tackle it, and they did it beautifully. The way that it is rolled out and the simultaneous journeys that these characters are on, and even that the mom is on and what she's doing for her kids, and she's just wanting them to be safe, and she's following them on the journey, and she's got her own life that she's
there's so
put
many
back
journeys.
Together.
Shoot, you could yeah. even say, if you're a stepdad, you could probably take a note from Officer
from
Bronco. Like, he did everything he could, but he also stayed out of it when needed.
Yes.
Right? Because this had to do with their father. And that's a very delicate subject
and
for
he's
a stepdad.
Cop. He's a cop for a reason.
Oh, yeah. So there's that. And then even the manticore, right? Her life, like, is not where it was supposed to be. And she's reinvigorated
she's
by this
quest. All-powerful creature who's lost all of her power and might and her resolve. And she owns this Chuck E. Cheese-like restaurant.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot that this movie doesn't shy away from saying, hey, you're the manicure, you're the elf, you're the stepdad, you're the mom. Now, let's show you how all of these characters within this world we've created are going to handle it to where we can maybe help and lend a helping hand and show you how you can tackle these sorts of same similar situations that folks are in. Yeah. Not that people don't handle them for the most part under their own accord, but people need help when it comes to some of these emotional discussions that they're not willing to, you know, raise
they don't know
within
how.
Their family units, or they don't know how, yeah. for example.
And honestly, you might be able to feel this movie if you're an older brother or sister.
Man, that's why I shed tears. That's why I shed a tear, bro. Yeah.
Well, also, maybe you feel a little slighted if your parents treat your younger brother or sister a little bit better than you did growing up. And that seems to happen a lot. Maybe because they're first-time parents, they didn't know how to deal with it, so they're a little bit harder, and then they relax. I mean, there's all reasons why that happens, but definitely sometimes the older brother or sister gets a little... They feel slighted too, you know, like they didn't get the good stuff like the younger brother.
My brother and I have two younger brothers that are half brothers from my biological mother, but my stepdad is their dad. So if I were to watch this movie with both of my brothers, I would have been bawling by the end of this because that is what brought out the emotion in me at the end of this film was that I do posit myself as the I associated more with Barley than anyone else in this movie because I understood what some of the dialogue that Chris Pratt, who plays Barley brilliantly and perfect casting choice, but the dialogue like, you know, for once I'd like you to just go with the way that I think is the right way, the path of peril being the best route to getting the Eye of the Phoenix, or what they refer, the Gem of the Phoenix.
Yeah.
Yes. So as an older brother, you're the middleman between the parents and the brother. You can sort of work as a filter to say, aha,
you're the next in line.
Yes. You can work as a filter to make sure that the information making its way from the matriarchal and patriarchal sources is real, and it's tangible and it's helpful.
Yeah. Well, usually they'll listen to you over a parent sometimes. Yes. Not all the time, but sometimes they'll take your advice more than the parent's advice because you're more to the level. Like, I've seen that. So I get you, man. I think that if everybody had siblings like this or close to, or at least people that could come around, you know, because a lot of people are stuck in that Barley and Ian Lightfoot
battle,
and they never
snap out of it. It takes time.
Well, it also took an act of selflessness, and a lot of people are unwilling to depart, or at least the younger person.
It takes time, too. Well, you need time spent with your siblings. You need a journey to go
like a road
on, and road trip, or just time spent with them to break through those thresholds. And that's another reason why I was emotional watching this movie, is because it made me look back at the last 15 years of my life with my brothers. We have 10 years apart. I'm 30.
My sister is 7.5 years older than me, so I get
you. So you have a large gap of age.
I understand that, and just like theirs.
I have 10 to 15 years between... I'm sorry.
I'm the youngest, though, so
I... 8 years between me and my middle brother, and 10 years between me and my youngest brother. And the experiences, it's my job as an older brother to find experiences that we can share together and get something out of.
And grow.
Yeah, and strangely enough, the one for me and my brothers was Magic the Gathering. We, about 5 or 6 years ago, I just had enough of not being able to, you know, experience life with my brothers on the level that I wanted to. And some of the things and their hobbies didn't mesh with my hobbies. But I introduced Magic to the Gathering to them around our kitchen table in the early 2010s. And when we did that, something clicked between all of us. And my younger brother, it took him a little longer to get on board. He thought we were nerds, and he thought we were just wasting our time buying these packs and playing day in, day out. But as soon as he played, he became the biggest proponent for Magic the Gathering. And he took the level.
Yes.
He took the level of fandom through the roof. And that is the power of finding something that y'all can enjoy together, whether it's movies or one of these
magic, foosball,
anything,
whatever,
ping pong. What you have to do, disc golf in the case of me and my middle brother, that's your responsibility as a sibling, because the parents,
but not everybody takes that responsibility. And that's what I'm saying is that this is a good relationship.
Yes.
This is how it should go.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing I loved about Barley's, his disposition in the movie is that he always stays optimistic. He never blames Ian. He's always looking out for him.
Yeah.
Even when Ian is super mean and unnecessarily like blaming him
for stuff.
Do you
hear that? It's the middle brother who's mean. It's not the older brother.
Well, he's the youngest brother. No, I'm
just
saying.
That's true. In their case, it's just two.
It took Ian his selflessness in order for him to, because it was Ian's. It was all Ian distancing himself. It wasn't Bartley. Bartley was all about being in his little brother's life, and he was embarrassed.
But they didn't mesh.
They didn't mesh
their
because took two different things from their father's death.
Yes.
I mean, Bartley took that, I'm never going to fear anything again because I didn't get to say goodbye to my dad. And so you see how his life took a turn to where he was fearless, and that probably made him go down some wrong paths, you know, maybe didn't keep him to
a little
keep going
more
a certain
reckless.
Way. Yes, a little bit more reckless. Mm-hmm. And Ian took it as I don't have anybody to teach me how to be a man.
Yeah.
And I don't know how to make friends, even though Bartley was there.
I've got a reckless older brother.
I don't want to be like him. I want to be like this this idea of my dad, mm-hmm. you know? And sometimes ideas, and people do this in their relationships and their friendships, they'll put an idea on somebody that isn't actually them, especially on somebody that's no longer there, right?
Yes.
And those expectations can hurt you and the person you're putting it on. And with Ian, I think it was hurting him because he felt like he wasn't living up to this image of his father. Like his father went to this university and his father was this good at being a wizard and his father, all these things. And he's like, even
that's
in his
why he
list,
comes up with his list of
and he
things.
Says, be like dad, yeah. right at the end. And he marks off everything because he doesn't get anything done in
he
his first list.
He scratches it all out.
Invite people to a party and he yeah. tries, he writes it on his hand, and he gets it all over his face. He's embarrassed
as soon
by
as
Bartley.
He, as soon as he tries to get the check marks in place, he fails at getting them in yeah. place because he didn't never had that guidance. Yeah. He doesn't know how to
even
navigate.
Sticking up for himself when that guy has got his troll feet on his desk
yeah.
and he's like
the dragon.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's like, you know, he has these good goals, right? He knows how to be a better person. He just can't do it.
See
for
them
the
through.
It's the fear.
Yep.
It's the fear of the unknown. It's and actually when you look at it, it actually has to do with the three ways he becomes magic, right? One is his heart's fire. Which is his desire, right? He's like, Chris Pratt's like, your heart's fire, you know? Olivia or whatever, he's yes. trying to lift things. The next one is self-belief when he's going across the bridge, right? You have to believe in yourself. The third one is focus, man. All three of those things were the three rules.
That's magic.
To, in order to make the magic work, right?
Yep.
And those were also the three rules to get those things off his checklist. If he had those things, in which he had to take that road trip with his older brother to learn those things, to be put in uncomfortable positions for his brother's recklessness, to get him into these, you know, situations like with the pixies, you know?
It just dawned on me that me and my brother went on a road trip about a year and a half ago. And here's how funny the correlation of this movie is. We haven't introduced one of the biggest characters in the film, Guinevere. His van. So
Guinevere.
The part where he sacrifices Guinevere and that's sort of his...
Already his, there, man. Okay. We can talk about her a little bit before we killed her off.
Okay, well, we'll fast forward. Guinevere's a van that Bartley has grown very close to.
Yes, with
that
Pegasus.
That has a Pegasus
unicorn.
On the side, which, strangely enough, Disney, I learned, likes to sneak in spoiler alerts to their next movie because mm-hmm. all these movies take so long to come up with that they've all been in the think tank as it's referred to for some amount of years. So they have a good symbiosis amongst all of them. The last movie was Toy Story 4 and they threw the Pegasus yes. on the side of the van. I think has a couple of highlights at the carnival that they
yes.
go to.
Well, also, you got to remember, mm-hmm. That's why people think that all the Pixar movies take place in one universe. And they all everybody's been trying to connect the dots
makes
of
sense.
What timeline
yeah.
that things have been on. So there's all, look on YouTube, you can go down the rabbit hole, literally tie in like all what
the
17?
Rabbit hole I went down instantly is Bambi and Zootopia.
Oh, gosh. No.
Zootopia is a movie we could talk about.
Well, Zootopia is
apparently
connected to this movie as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but let's keep going.
Okay.
Guinevere.
My story, yeah, Guinevere, the scene where she sacrificed and the parking tickets come out of
the wings.
Glove compartment.
And then
it's
the
beautiful.
Tire blows out like it's galloping.
Yes. The parking tickets specifically. Me and my brother went on a road trip a year and a half ago to Missouri. It was one of our bonding moments over the course of the last 10 years for sure. On the way back, I'm the reckless older brother. I drove the entire way and I drove the entire way back. Now, my brother said he wanted to drive, but I said, nah, man, maybe next trip, but this is the trip where I drive us there and I drive us back. So on the way back, I hit the highway doing about 85, 90, feeling good about the trip we'd just been on. And we got pulled over right off the jump. And so here I am being an example to my brother for the most part. 90% of the time, I would like to think that I am a good foot forward and a good big brother. But there's that 10% where I'm reckless and I'm breaking the law. And there's a tie-in to this in Onward. There's a lot of law breaking going on in this movie. There's some
breaking the law.
There's some territory that Disney movies have not gone down when it comes to, you're dealing with high school kids at the end of the day, so, and a college kid. So that's something in itself. This isn't a kids movie for this isn't a kids movie. This isn't under 10-year-old movie.
I think an under 10-year-old could watch it and not understand all those things. Yeah, but they'll enjoy it.
They'll enjoy the art and all that.
Yeah, but the funny moments.
They will also get bored very quickly. I threw this on for my 3-year-old. Well, not for her, but while my 3-year-old was in the room, and she just went off and did her own thing.
Oh, that's sad. Maybe they have to be a little bit older, maybe.
Yeah, just a bit.
Maybe like 7 to 10.
Throw Secret Life of Pets and she's in love.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, who doesn't like pets?
That's a great movie.
Yeah, man, I love Guinevere.
Side story.
You know, it was me and my friend Angel. Shout out to Angel because he listens to.
Shout out to Angel.
Yeah, he
Aquaman.
He was telling me that part where, you know, it's not too far forward, not too far back. It's a sweet spot when he's trying to turn on the engine for the first time. And he said he busted out, and so did I, man, because I used to have a truck just like that, and it was even worse. Mine. Not only could I not go too far forward, too far back, I had to pump the gas pedal 3 times at just the right time to turn on my truck at the same time. So it's like I grew up with a crappy piece of junk too.
You just brought up a beautiful example, not only of the life stories that we have and how this movie brings all of those flooding back. And that's kind of what it's doing right now with me. And the other thing is your buddy, Angel. And even if you're a single lonely child, even if you're an only child, is it only or lonely?
Only.
Okay.
Only the lonely.
Okay. Even if you're an only child, throughout life, you're going to have friends in your life that are symbolic of a bigger brother or a younger brother style of relationship. Mm-hmm. The universe has a very interesting way of providing that for you. Even if you don't have it at home, it's something that almost every human being who's on a path of growth has to experience to be able to get the vibes for it, and love and compassion for another person who's not your significant other or your parent or your child. You have to experience the love of another person who's not necessarily related to you. So a close friend, whatnot.
Hopefully, but they're good people.
Yeah,
hopefully you can have a bad mentor.
Yeah, that's true. We've got best friends in our life that we've known for a long period of time who we would probably consider brothers or sisters and of that same cloth. They're not for our sure. blood brothers or our blood sisters.
They're family by choice.
You yourself were in a fraternity, so you know what it is a brotherhood. Yeah. And this movie does such a good job to where, again, I can't detach myself from it being a story of brothers, but I can detach myself from it being a story about, you know, my blood brothers, and it's really a story about me and my closest
chosen
friends.
Brothers.
Yes. Yeah. But at the same time, it's a story about your blood brothers as well. It's so beautiful how it all ties that together. And it really paints a poetic picture for these two brothers to be engaged in this journey on. You almost need the journey in this movie to take place because it's the only conduit for their magic to reignite. Not only the magic, the
I think we forgot to tell people that their dad... becomes halfway.
Well, we haven't even gotten there. They need the magic first to come and introduce
itself. Well, no, he's gotten
itself.
Halfway.
They need the magic first. There? No, we haven't gotten there. But it's okay. We're going to fast forward through the questing part of the
quest
movie.
Quest of Yore.
because the reintroduction of the magic into these brothers' world is that they find a spell that can potentially bring their deceased father back.
Well, their dad left it for them.
Yes. And so, again, the whole vibes of being a legacy for your children and showing them a path rears its head here in a positive light. And even though Ian did not have a relationship with his dad knew that there was the potential to not have a relationship with his son if grave circumstances followed. So he left the trail to sort of reignite that potential.
We don't even know how he died, to be honest. No, we don't.
I mean, Disney doesn't want to do that with this
movie. I speculate
movie.
Cancer, though. It couldn't have been something...
He was
horrible,
on tubes,
horrible.
Right?
Well, I mean, he must have... Yeah, I mean, they knew he was in the hospital. Yeah. He knew he was going to die, so he left that spell for his younger kids to get him back for one day. But
and they find him, they find the spell, and they do bring him back halfway, literally.
Well, Ian doesn't have enough heart's fire. No, he probably has a heart's fire, but he doesn't have focus or self-confidence. That's why maybe he got some way there, because he really desired to see his dad.
So they bring him back halfway, and
very Weekend at Bernie's.
Weekend at Bernie's is exactly where I was going with this, because they dress him up with a bubble jacket and some sunglasses and a hat, and
he's just dancing
pants,
around
the pants and the socks, the purple socks that were referred to earlier.
Cheshire cat. That's the first thing I thought of when those purple socks. Sounds like Cheshire cat. Because that's he reappears and disappears, Cheshire Cat, and little body parts and things. So it fits very... There's a lot of little Easter eggs that if you're a fan of all Pixar and Disney...
You'll dig
and
into it big
there's
time.
There's so many in here. Like, I can't even go through all of them.
And I guess the questing part of the movie kicks on because they want to get the second half of their dad back.
They have to get the Phoenix Gem.
And
another
one. They have to get the Phoenix Gem, and this works very similarly to any RPG video game or any quest within a video game itself. It's not really a whole game. It's the span of just a quest within this movie.
Well, you have to
if the quest
find
is,
the tavern.
Yeah, you have to find the tavern. You have to mingle with the common
drunkards.
Folk and the community. And then you...
Maybe get some help from an assassin or a mercenary.
You have to have a vehicle. All of it ties so beautifully together.
Trusty and steed.
There are a lot of odes and nods to how questing is tackled within all of these various fantasy realms.
But they all start at the tavern.
They do all start
it's
at the tavern.
It's pretty
Diablo
much
3 starts
oh,
at the tavern.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've played hundreds of hours of Diablo 3.
Elder Scrolls, you get to that first village,
same
man.
Thing. Yep.
You got to talk to the villagers.
And that's part of the juicy, like, just the lore and the love of those games is that you do have to build the fellowship. You have to build the bonds with the people. You have to acquire information from the townsfolk. You have to figure your way.
Now, the one thing
to
I would say,
step.
Like usually in an RPG game, right? You have these certain archetypes, right? Mm-hmm. So I definitely know Ian's a wizard archetype or like a magic wielder.
Yep.
But what is a Barley? I mean, I don't know if he's like the barbarian, like the, I guess you would call him a tank. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, I don't know if he's really that, or is he a bard?
He's definitely,
you know?
He's definitely the tank comparatively to his brother.
But he doesn't even actually do any fighting.
He doesn't need to. It's
he doesn't
a Disney
really.
Movie.
I know, but it's like,
and
usually
no
you have some kind of like, well, in an RPG world and video game worlds, you usually have at least the four types, right? You have the healer, the wizard, or the magic dealer, right? You have the rogue, and you have the tank.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Or the rogue would be the damage dealer.
They're referred
right?
to as builds. Yeah.
Yeah. Builds. How,
character
I call them
builds.
Archetypes. Yeah. But those are your four main ones. And there's little, you know, offshoots of each depending on how you like to play. Well, for me, you just have the wizard here. What is Barley? He's definitely not a rogue. He's definitely maybe a tank, but I didn't see him soaking up any, you know, if anybody's taking hits, it's Ian.
He's almost like a tutorial for Ian the whole time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because...
He's definitely not a healer.
Because by the end of the movie, Ian realizes that his brother was... I don't want to get there yet, but he does realize that his brother was sort of his guide. That
was his father.
For
really.
All of the missing elements that he didn't get to experience with his dad. And it's a really poetic ending. Because, yeah, they go on this quest with their dad, with the bottom half at least, the Weekend at Bernie's version. They go to try to spend a day, and you're realizing as the movie progresses that the day is coming to an end and they haven't reached it. And they get a little bit of time at the end with a lot of stuff mixed in between, of course. I mean, there's so much to talk about with the movie when it comes to the side characters, but let's jump ahead to the ending just a little bit, because the quest is to bring back their dad to, so that Ian can experience the time with their dad that they never had. They want to do that within a day, which is already a limited amount of time. Then it turns into a half day. Then it turns into really an hour. Then it turns into 10 minutes. And by the end of the story, Ian...
Now, here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
At the end, they did finish their quest.
Yes.
It wasn't quite the quest that kept them behind. In fact, there was a moment where Ian and Barley... You know, there's been several times where Ian has hurt Barley throughout this, and Barley has stayed optimistic and stayed by his side. Starting from the point where he told Barley that he thinks he is a screw up, basically by being they took a magical version of themselves as Officer Bronco
to try to get out of a sticky situation with the cops when they got pulled over, and you couldn't lie, otherwise part of your
magic
would dissolve, and Ian was faced with the tough question of
they were almost
is your
out
brother
of it too.
A screw up, because the cops mentioned it, and that's when he
said
started
no,
corroding.
And-
yeah.
And that was very harsh, you know, and he's very hurt where he turns up the music, you know, and he pulls in to go get something out of the convenience store, the vending machine. And that's when they have their first laugh together, right?
Yes. They dance. Because of the dad.
Yeah. And, you know, there's been a few times where Ian's done this to Barley, but Barley has gotten over it and been the bigger brother and been positive, even at the point where at the end, Ian is so upset that the end of the quest ends up at the beginning, at the school. They come out of a sewer grate after they go through this, all these tests, these, you know, gauntlet with the, you know, the
Barley
gelatinous cube.
Barley doesn't give up.
Yeah, Barley doesn't give up. Even though Ian says some mean things to him that he is a screw up and he should get out of
all
and
the
he
way
goes with
to
his
the
dad.
End. Yep.
But Barley is still determined because he knows that there has to be something around here, and he figures out the piece.
He jumps up on that rock and he finds...
Which is funny because at the beginning, he is the protester at that place saying, don't tear this down. This is history.
Yep.
You know, which is maybe an ode to Chris Pratt's character from Parks and Rec, you know, always
maybe
getting in the
way. That is a deep dive right there, bro. Yep.
I'm telling you.
For sure.
And Rec's fan.
Is it Parks and Rec that is making they're making a revival
comeback
episode of that. Yeah. Yep. So they're doing all of that.
But yeah, so I want to give a shout out to those older brothers or siblings that never gave up hope, even though their little brother might have been more selfish or self-centered because they weren't old enough or they didn't realize it. The good news about what I love about the story, when I said it was a healthy relationship, is when Ian figures out from that list and he's actually introspective and says, damn, I've been selfish, or my bigger brother's been there for me the whole time.
He's been the dad that I never had,
exactly,
or as close to it as possible.
He experienced his dad through him. So it requires the other party, too. You can't just sit there and be bad to your upper or lower sibling, you know, older or younger sibling, and expect them to just always be around.
Yeah.
It takes both sides, and I give Barley all the credit for just taking crap after crap, and then Ian finally comes around, and that's what made this story so beautiful, because when he figures that out, he comes back for his bigger brother and he defends him, and he actually has to sacrifice
the time that he wanted so bad with his dad. And he gets buried under some rocks after taking care of the dragon.
Well, the rocks
the
are around
makeshift
him.
Dragon.
The dragon was hilarious.
That is
dude,
a funny part.
The school
bell.
Yeah.
The school bell yawn.
But
that's,
you know what?
That's a really
their
funny
mother
moment.
Is definitely a warrior. Is definitely a tank. So is the manticore. I guess the manticore is a real tank since she took it on the back.
Yep.
But at the end, what's beautiful is that, and you kind of realize this when they're floating down the Cheeto. Sorry if you haven't seen the movie and you don't get that reference.
Spoilers abound. It's okay.
They make a big Cheeto and they're floating down. But when he tells them that, you know, his fourth memory, he didn't like to tell because his dad was on tubes. That's when I realized Barley needs to see his dad more than Ian, because Ian's never had him. But Barley was there for Ian.
Barley had it
didn't
taken
have anybody.
Away. Yeah, there's something to be said for when you've lost something that you've never had, you don't have the same sort of There's no gravitas there. You don't know what you have. You don't know what you got till it's gone, is the old saying. But Ian never had it to begin with. So, yeah. I mean, granted, there's that.
It's still a big sacrifice.
It is Ian, a big sacrifice.
Because even
I'm
though.
I'm sure he has 100 questions.
Yeah.
But Barley could get more done in that 10 minutes of time. And he's learned that Barley can funnel the information down to him.
I think the real reason, though, is that Ian realized that Barley has unfinished business with the father.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wasn't able to say goodbye. And it would be selfish of Ian. And Barley would never grow if he never got that moment to go get. And that's where the title comes from. Onward, right? Barley cannot move onward without saying bye to his dad.
We've given four reasons why the movie was named Onward.
And Ian has to move forward onward because Barley was there for him. And Barley never had anybody there to guide him but his mom. And it's different. And I might get a lot of flack for this, but look, I give a lot of credit out there to single moms out there. You guys are awesome. But
they
there
play
is
all the roles.
Yeah, but there is something from another man teaching another boy how to be a man. There's a difference there. And I don't know how to quantify that, to be honest. I just know that it is important to have, too, at least some kind of man mentor, whether it's your brother or your friend or something like that. And
I think
Barley
it works,
never had that.
I think it does work itself out in real life, regardless of the situation. So
it can,
I can look at all the intangibles of it and say, like, in my personal situation, it was my grandfather or my stepdad who stepped in and played the role. But even if you don't have that, then kids who are raised by the single mother are typically gravitate to athletes or rock stars, or they'll whether that's right or wrong, they'll look at a male figure who is in a leadership role and they'll cling to that person. So you can sort of see it. I know I see it amongst friends who I know have similar stories to mine, that grew up and their fathers left them at a very early age, left the whole family unit. They cling to, like, Michael Jordan's, Kobe Bryant's, people who have stepped up and had big prominent roles. And that's not to say that maybe they're just not admirers of that person, but there's something more there when I look at how my friends who didn't grow up with a father treat the athlete or whatnot, and maybe they were living with their single mom and didn't have the relationship with their grandfathers that I had. It's still, the universe still has to fill that gap, because in order for someone to reach their ultimate destiny when it comes to being a competent man and a well put together sort of emotional being, you have to have that role. You have to have the fatherly advice and the consultant type being in your life. It's just unavoidable.
Yeah,
a lot of people turn to God for it, and seek out a relationship with God. Mm-hmm. If none of it is available, there's always the caveat of having God available. So if you don't have the male figures in your life, you've got the church.
That's true. And, you know, I just think it's a beautiful story that of self-sacrifice on both parts. And and actually, every story in here is filled to the brim. Like, even like I said, Officer Bronco. I mean, those kids, I mean, Ian and Barley treat him like, you know, they're laughing at him. They make fun of him behind his back. But this dude is straight up to the mom, you know? Yeah. He's always answering to her. He tries to get back these kids that ran away. He's trying not to get involved when they're trying to get with their father. He seems like a good dude, you know? And that's something that, you know, even he had to endure, had to sacrifice. Even the Manticore, even the mother, all these people have juicy stories that they all sort of moved onward, even in their smallest of ways.
Yes.
And
you can't dedicate an hour and a half to each one of them.
You can touch on them.
You
for
have
sure.
to, because their stories are important too. And the movie does a really good job of that. This is one of the more well-rounded films. I know it's received a ton of criticism, strangely, but I think that's because of what the critics bring into it that they're not going to like. Yes.
Yeah.
And I think that speaks volumes. If you are a person who can understand all of the characters and all of the journeys and mini journeys that they're on, and you can empathize with them, you're going to look at this movie as an accomplishment that Disney has not really gotten, because they try to do it with Toy Story. All the toys have their own different stories, and that's why people love Toy Stories, because it's jumbling up so many different things, but this one does it on a human level where it's like,
even though there's no humans,
there's no humans. It does it on a human level better than a lot of its predecessors, in my opinion. There's not many movies, Inside Out even, which is tackling emotions like to the T. It's saying this is what emotions work like within a child and within life and the evolution of the child and the different environments that the child could be in. Even it had some setbacks because it was compartmentalized and it was really just a young girl going through moving from one city to another and being introduced into new variables. This does so much more than what its surface level introduces that it's applaudable in so many fields. Yeah, it's a special movie.
I'm gonna take a lot of flack for this, but I'm one of those people that actually didn't like Frozen that much. And the reason is because they actually had real villains in it.
Okay.
Like the two guys that were trying to hook up with them, they were real villains. And it made it really bad to me. I didn't like that. That wasn't a Disney film. This didn't have villains like that.
It's a hell of a thing to put in front of kids and say, hey, maybe you can live life without villains as well. You can live your life trying
not everybody's
to find
a villain
the,
if they're
trying to
you.
Seek the best. Just don't watch the platform afterwards.
Yeah. So, I mean, look, man, I really liked Onward. I think it had really great messages. It didn't paint really anybody as a true villain. Everybody had their own perspectives and their own backstories.
There's definitely obstacles.
They were obstacles. So
they're inanimate obstacles.
Can be obstacles.
Yeah.
Are they evil? Most of the time, not. Yeah. And they don't even care about your perspective or what your goals are. And they may be an obstacle, but that doesn't make them evil. And that's why I feel, personally, I didn't like Frozen because they needed a villain to make these sisters to come closer. But this story did not need a villain to make these two guys to come closer. They actually had a father that was absent to make them grow closer.
Yes.
And a self-sacrifice to give the other person what they didn't even know they needed, because Barley was ready to sacrifice like this for Ian. And he expected that. He wanted to give that to his brother. And when his brother realized that he needed to give something to his brother, and that's a beautiful moment. I love when somebody has self recognition and realizes something they've been doing wrong, and they change it.
Be
better.
Yeah,
and that is the mark of, for me, a real hero. I love flawed heroes and I love flawed villains, because overcoming things is what this movie is about. It's what Onward is about, moving forward, right? And how can you do that if you don't let go of certain expectations or ideas or things that you thought defined you, like Ian's father? It defined him, but it really didn't, when he realized Barley was the connection to his father, was the conduit. That's how he knew his father, who Barley is. And when he let that go, he became a better person. Barley made him a better person, you know? And Ian, in turn, makes Barley a better person. And they grew together in the end. And even their mother grows.
Yeah, there's not a lot of... I agree with everything you just said, and it hit the nail on the head. My only follow-up is that there doesn't... Like we said, there doesn't have to be a villain. There doesn't have to be a lot of cynicism either. And in movies from Disney and Pixar in the past, there's been a heavy dose of cynicism, from what I gathered, like the Toy Story Toy Inferno scene.
Oh my God.
That's like
I'm still traumatized.
That's traumatizing for
and they all held
us,
hands
and we're
too
in our
30s.
Oh God. So come on, we can steer away from that. We've hammered that message home enough through Disney and Pixar movies that I think we're ready to move onward from that entire scope of messages and what we're trying to it's there. So if somebody wants to revisit it and rekindle that sort of feeling, and they feel like the world is oppressive and that there are evil individuals and that there are evil corporations out there bent on holding you down, you've got a litany of Disney movies that'll do it for you. But as we move onward, and this goes back to what, you know, as a dad, I'm trying to do with my relationship with my daughter, is I'm trying to make the obstacles that have been in my way seem a little less daunting for her to have to experience in life. And I think movies provide we talked about this on episode one, they provide a real legitimate route for people to face their fears on a screen and say, okay, this movie's done that now, and here's a way for me to make it through this quest with the help and the advice of what the film is telling me to do. And this movie does it better in the Disney Pixar landscape than any other Disney Pixar movie I've seen in recent memory. I may have to revisit the stuff from the 90s and the 2000s to see, but I don't see a more poignant modern day take. Even though it's a brother story, it's a story of brothers, like we said in this episode, you can take your best friend, you could take
your sister,
certainly there's cousins. Somebody in your life you can take and
hopefully
insert in the role of Barley and you as Ian, or even interchange it and you can say, oh, I'm Barley here and this is my Ian, and you make it work together, you make it mesh, and you say, okay, yeah, this is good stuff and a good educational film for moving onward. Yeah, it's hard. We come back to that
onward.
Circular.
How many times have
discussion.
We said onward?
Onward. So, in closing, that's what we should do. And moving onward with the film room, as we exit this period of quarantine and moving onward into what the real world brings, as far as obstacles are concerned to us. I cannot wait to tackle more movies with you, more movies that are difficult to talk about when it comes to this level of depth and discussion. But we said it earlier this afternoon when we were taking a pee break. We are filling voids when it comes to some of these discussions that we're having. I feel as if you and I can discuss them on levels that not many other people can discuss. You can't emulate this. You can't go to school for this. The school is watching the movies and watching them and understanding them and all their facets and their intricacies.
I think my friend Chris Diaz said this before to me. He said, we're all critics of movies because we've all been watching them our whole lives.
Yeah.
We've all had a master class in movies if you're paying enough attention.
10,000 hours is the old adage that you need to be a master of anything.
I definitely think we've had...
I think we're on 10,000 hours.
Oh my God, that makes
movies.
Me think. I hope like when I'm on my last breath, I'm not just remembering movies
all
I watched
movies.
Instead of my life. But yeah, man, I think this is one of those movies that I'm going to be able to put on in the background and be good with.
Yeah.
You know, like you don't always have to watch it, but it's fun to have on the background. It's good to watch. It's good to be a part of it. It's good to remind yourself that too, because the reason why I love fantasy so much is because of magic. And
Magic the Gathering?
No, actual magic, yeah. You know? Just think of me putting glitter in the air when I say that, magic. But yeah, I love the things. I do a lot of research on things. It's just the way my mind works. But I love the unknown a lot of the times too.
Like same here.
I believe that there is some kind of magic that we haven't uncovered.
Or refound.
I mean, I just think science is a method for uncovering what the magic of the world is, the universe,
sir.
Right?
I think that's what it was set up to be, but unfortunately, I don't think
well,
that
science
is what
just
it perpetuates
a method.
These
it's not
years.
Even a subject anymore. It's a method. So I think science just is trying to uncover the universe's secrets, except we don't know much. We just know the surface area. That's where our science, even though our science is awesome, but relatively, we don't know much about the universe. And I think there's a lot of magic out there to be discovered. And I love watching movies about magic because it reminds me that just being alive is magic. Just being born. I mean, it's weird that we're humans, right? It's weird that we're here. It's weird that we look up to the sky at night and we can see other universes out there in a black ink, you know? It's very science fiction. It's very fantasy.
Wondrous.
Yeah, it's wondrous. Mm-hmm. And I constantly try to live my life where I'm more wondrous like a child.
Sure.
And this movie helps me feel like that. It reminds me.
Because it taps into your adult wondrous side,
yeah,
too.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I love RPGs, which is role-playing games for people that don't play those games or do those kind of things. I'm into Dungeons & Dragons now. And this movie made me want to go play an old game that I used to play, which was called Fable on the original Xbox.
Great game. Classic
yeah,
game.
I went back and for some reason it was for free on Xbox. I downloaded
it. Can we see a Fable Netflix series instead of The Witcher, please?
Right.
I mean, The Witcher's got the sex, the violence, and all that. And yeah, I know that's what
it's much more adult.
Fable, I would like to see a Fable game.
Very English fairy tale game. Film.
Yep.
Where you can be evil or good, which I always picked good because I can't stand to be a bad guy, even in
Paragon
the digital
is
world.
Bad, right?
Paragon's good.
Paragon's good. Good. Yeah, okay. That's what I
typically
think.
Yeah, but
the terminology eludes me sometimes.
Yeah. So if you watch this movie, you might get this nostalgic feeling to go play Dungeons and Dragons or Magic the Gathering or Fable or Skyrim or something like that. Because, well, Skyrim's a little bit more adult, but you get this feeling of like this camaraderie when you have a group of people, the fellowship, mm-hmm. like Lord of the Rings. And every nod, like you said, even toward at the end, you got a Back to the Future reference, basically, when they fly off in the new Guinevere, which, oh, sorry, we forgot. Spoiler alert, Guinevere 2 makes it back.
Absolutely.
By the way, I didn't mean to put any bad news on this, but I heard that Disney is being sued by the original owner of that van that they took the...
the Chevy van?
Yeah, that somebody actually had that Pegasus on the side, and I think they're under a lawsuit about it.
Give them the $5 million, Disney. Get over it.
Well, I honestly don't even know how you would... trademark that. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Like, I mean, don't you just have a weird van like that?
I mean, the name Guinevere itself is of King Arthur lore and whatnot.
Well, not the name, but the actual design of the van.
Oh, like I know. But what I'm saying is they're not getting sued from the publishing companies that own the rights to King Arthur lore and King Arthur stories.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, it's 100 years. It becomes public after 100 years. So that's Guinevere, I don't know when King Arthur or the Camelot was written, but I imagine it was probably over 100 years ago.
16th century.
Oh, was it 16th century? So yeah, I think that's up for grabs now. Maybe 18th century. That's the reason why Walt Disney went with Grimm fairy tales and Arabian Nights.
Nice.
Those are all
up for grabs.
Now, you can't do their particular story, like The Little Mermaid or something like that, but the original stories you can definitely do to your heart's content.
Well,
or change
been
it
out
your
since
way.
The 40s, so you could take the, well, we're not there. How, we're not 100 years.
Yeah, that's 20 more years, but hey, if you want to redo Bambi, I mean, I don't know how you would do it live action. I guess you just put a hunter out there. But I feel that
they're
Onward,
gonna do it.
Onward was a good take on it had a real good feel of the pulse of the public on what they feel about magic as well, and how it's grown prevalent in communities. I think Dungeons and Dragons is much more accepted now because of Stranger Things and other movies and TV shows that have made it come
it
out of this.
Because
before Dungeons and Dragons were seen as devil worshiping, like in the 80s or 90s, like people were really scared of it.
And then the Jeremy Irons Dungeons and Dragons changed all that. We will not be discussing that film on the film room.
That was so bad. I think we even mentioned that with Marlon Wayans back in the day. God, man. But yeah, I really do think that...
Highest recommendation.
Please avoid at all costs.
No, Onward.
Oh, Onward, yes. Mm-hmm. Onward is highest recommendation. For me, I know this is a... crazy, but I'm gonna give it 10 out of 10, and it might
even do ratings, but I know this movie brought it out of you. Huh? 10 out of 10.
I may be a little biased because and what's weird, I don't have an older brother, mm-hmm. but I freaking love this.
We're
a younger brother.
I haven't mentioned that at all because I do think it is my role to play in this movie to bring the perspective of Barley in it. But yeah, you don't even have an older or a younger brother, but you resonated with this movie so much.
I didn't
but
grow up with an older or younger brother, sorry.
But you do have a brotherhood existing.
Yeah, through friends. Friends have had to become my family because I moved around a lot, and then, you know, I moved away at 18, as soon as I became 18, to a different city. So yeah, I mean, I've been Ian, and I've also been Barley, and... man, I love both of these characters for their flaws and for their strengths. And I'm glad that they were able to overcome their flaws in order to produce this great story that resonates within all of us, that touches all of our hearts, regardless of sex or race or being friendless or having friends. I think that everybody wants this, and everybody can take a note from everybody in this movie and try to make their lives better. Go on a quest.
Yeah, absolutely. That's the magic right there. The magic is in the quest and the journey. We hear that saying all the time. It's not about the end result. It's about how you got there. And that's exactly what this movie proves as well. So yeah, I mean, Onward is, we've touched on all the various meanings of the movie, and it doesn't stop there either. I want to see a sequel out of this because I want to see them go on a second quest.
I would love
builds their relationship. That's probably going to be the name of the movie.
But this time with the more people.
Or side quests.
Yeah, this time they'll actually have the builds with them.
Exactly. They won't be more cool. NPC-ish than as they were in here. There were about six main characters in this movie, or six minor characters, and then your two major characters. Yeah. So I'd like to see more of a Fellowship-style movie in a sequel, for sure.
I'm totally down. Please make it happen.
Oh, they will.
Just if you're out there, wizards, please come up.
Spell slingers.
Please come up with a better name than Wilden the Whimsical. That's all I'm asking. And on that,
parting wishes. Yeah. Onward we go.